You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Soccer Report Extra podcast. This week, it's Bobby flying solo. Well, we've got Luke at the controls, of course, because you don't want me at the controls. Some people may even say they don't want me on the mic, but you've got me anyway, so let's get going. Looking back on the weekend, start off with that. English Cup final, my opinion, massive disappointment. Game that never really had much spark. Chelsea, I think, the slightly better team. Manchester United huffed and puffed, but that was about it. And probably it was a microcosm of the kind of season that Manchester United have had. Get results now and again, but generally the performance not that great. Just devoid of creativity. Getting in and around the penalty box, they never really created too many clear cut chances. Conte had, I think, Chelsea well prepared. Obviously, that goal that came early, a rash challenge from Jones that probably shouldn't have happened, a little bit of controversy. There shouldn't have been controversy either, quite clearly, 2 years ago when they changed the laws of the game. To avoid the triple jeopardy situation with penalty kicks that everybody seemed to want, but some of the commentators, some of the media seemed to have failed to have kept up with the rule change and suggested that Phil Jones should have been sent off for that. But of course, not for the first time this season, Michael Oliver actually got it right. So Chelsea, perhaps along with Arsenal, certainly the team, the FA Cup team of the 21st century. So many of Chelsea's trophies have come, they waited so long before they actually won the cup way back, I think it was 1970 when they beat Leeds United in the replay, and then they started hitting their stride in the 90s, and they've been certainly up there and won along with Arsenal as a dominant FA Cup team over the last number of years. So Conte, as strange it may seem, 2 years in charge of Chelsea, win the league, runners up in the cup last year, failed in to beat Arsenal. Arsenal beat them 2-1, but comes back this year. Not so much such a great showing in the league, but wins the cup final this year. So two trophies, 2 years, and it looks like he'll be fired or he'll resign. But I guess there'll be a big check in the mail for Conte, and we will wait with bated breath to see where he will finish up. Looks like Mancini's got the Italian job, so he's not going to go back there. So, but there'll be lots of opportunities, no doubt, for somebody like Conte and somebody with his sort of resume. So, interestingly enough, the German Cup final on the same day threw up a surprise, a massive surprise, really, when you think about it, and you look at the standings. Eintracht Frankfurt beat Bayern Munich 3-1. They took the lead, 1-0. Then Lewandowski scored just after half time, and I'm sure I wasn't the only one that thought, "Oh yeah, here we go. Same old story, same old script. Bayern Munich will find a way of winning this, even if it's a scramble goal in the 90th minute." But it didn't work out that way. And a few minutes to go, 9 minutes to go, I think it was, Rebic scored the second goal. I thought it was an absolutely incredible effort by him. The pace he showed and the desire to get to the ball was outstanding. I gave him the lead. And then as Bayern Munich threw everybody forward, there's this incredible scene of Gacinovic breaking from just outside his own penalty area with Ulrich stranded in the Eintracht Frankfurt penalty area. And Gacinovic, as I mentioned in the Forbes column, probably fulfilled the dream of everybody that's ever kicked a ball, actually running almost the length of the park to score a goal, which turned out to be the not the winning goal, but certainly the goal that sealed the cup for Eintracht Frankfurt. And so I think you've got to go back about 30 years since Frankfurt last won that trophy. Bayern Munich, of course, you only have to go back a couple of weeks to the last trophy they won, and that was the Bundesliga. But they sent Jupp Heynckes into retirement once more, but not this time with a treble, but with just the Bundesliga. And probably some thoughts of what might have happened in terms of the Champions League. I think they felt they were the better team. I think a lot of neutrals thought they were the better team over the two legs against Real Madrid. But they lost that, and they lost this game at Eintracht Frankfurt. But of course, the twist in the tail on this one is Eintracht Frankfurt's coach, Niko Kovac, who was a Bayern Munich player around about, I guess it was about 2003-ish, Croatian international, had some time with the Croatian national team as a manager, but Eintracht Frankfurt was his first club management position. Of course, about a month ago, he signed on as the new Bayern Munich manager, so he will walk in to the Bayern Munich dressing room, probably sometime in July and August, and have a cup to his credit, and the team he beat to win that cup was the team he was going to take the reins of come July. So a kind of real twist to that tale. Of course, the third cup final, a third cup final on the weekend, with Celtic fairly easily disposed of Motherwell. Motherwell had a couple of chances, cracked one off the crossbar, but two early goals for Celtic. And Brendan Rodgers, one of these days he's going to work himself back into the Premier League, but at the moment he's 6-for-6 in Scotland, done something nobody has ever done before. Walter Smith stumbled at the last hurdle back in 1994. Jock Steen stumbled as well. I think it was maybe 1968 with Steen failing to do the back-to-back trebles. Brendan Rodgers has pulled this off. And considering the financial state of Scottish football and how dominant Celtic are, it's really difficult to see how that is going to change in the short term. And I think the challenge, as Rodgers said in an interview, is to somewhat forget about the trophies, but to really push through and try and improve the team. Now, how they do that, well, they're the dominant club in Scotland, with the crowds they get, the revenue they generate, especially when they get the Champions League. But Champions League qualification is going to be far more difficult next year, because they're going to cut down on the number of teams that are actually going to qualify from outside the bigger leagues. You've got the four big leagues that are automatically going to be given half the spots in the group stage. So that's 16 spots already gone out, the 32. And then Celtic will have to go through, because Scotland's results in Europe have been so dire over the last number of years, they'll have to go through the qualifying tournament. Instead of 10 spots overall for the two sides of the qualifying tournament, that will be down to 6. So that's even more difficult, perhaps, than it was before. So that's a real challenge for them. The other one, I guess, a cup final of sorts. It was tucked away, and unfortunately, I didn't see this game. Always, particularly being in Canada, always, I think you can watch it in the United States, but I always think it's unfortunate that Canada does not. Some of the broadcasters in Canada don't find a way to broadcast the Mexican League, or at least a highlights program. And in that one, we had Santos Laguna, who'd led the Clausura for a fairly, certainly in the early stages, till Toluca kind of took over. But Santos Laguna is a team that fans at MLS would be well acquainted with, the success that they've had in the CONCACAF Champions League a couple of years ago. And looks like they will be back in CONCACAF Champions League, I would expect anyway, sometime fairly soon. But they won over the two legs and beat Toluca, who had actually finished top of the regular standings in Liga MX. Anyway, that brings us to the conclusion of the first part, the recap of the weekend, and we'll be back in a second or so with a look at the Champions League.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra. Keep up to speed with the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen by liking us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to part two of the Soccer Report Extra podcast. It's Bobby McMahon flying solo this week. And we get to part two and the big game on the weekend, massive game on the weekend, Champions League final. Liverpool, five-time champions, back in the final for the first time since 2007. Won it, of course, with a miracle in Istanbul way back in 2005. Playing Real Madrid, the team that they actually beat in, I believe it was 1981, to win at that time what was the European Cup. And that was back in 81, was the real, right in the middle of the great English dominance of the European Cup. Nottingham Forest, Liverpool, Aston Villa all won the European Cup back from about 77 on to the early 80s. And that was the golden period for English football as far as European Cup success is concerned. In terms of golden periods for Spain, I guess we're in the middle of one. Atletico Madrid winning Europa League. The number of trophies, I think it's 8 out of the last 9, have gone to Spanish clubs, whether it be Europa League or the Champions League. God, old habits die hard. You know, we've had the tournament for over 25 years, but I still want to call it the European Cup. But between Real Madrid, Barcelona, Atletico, Sevilla, etc., etc., the dominant period there. You can go back, I guess, to the onset of the European Cup in the first tournament, 1955-56, when Real Madrid rattled off 5 in a row. Barcelona got to the final of 6 years, lost to Benfica. Real Madrid came back, lost to Benfica again. But that period of about, you know, they even had, another run at it, around about 64, I think they got to the final, Real Madrid, and lost that one to Inter, I believe. Luke will fact-check that one, see if my memory is serving me correctly. And then, of course, in 66, they beat Partizan Belgrade. And then we had this massive long, and I think, you know, when you're in the present, you tend to forget that there was a long time when Real Madrid dominated Spanish domestic football, but did really... very little in terms of the European Cup. They had some success in the UEFA Cup during the 80s, but as far as the European Cup was concerned, Real Madrid had kind of fallen off a lot of radars. And it wasn't until 1998, strangely enough, with Joep Heynckes, when they surprisingly beat Juventus, and I believe, you know, that was really the kind of the second spurt that Real Madrid had as far as European Cup stroke Champions League is concerned. And they went on, they had success, I guess, in Valencia, against Valencia in all Spanish. I think it was maybe a semi-final. They beat the fantastic goal that that Zidane struck against Bayer Leverkusen in 2002 at Hampden. You know, that was a great time, and then they went overboard in terms of the Galacticos and kind of hit the skids. And it's in the last few years, under assortment of managers, they seem to have done is what the likes of Liverpool had done, Ajax had done in the 70s, Bayern Munich had also done in the 70s, and I guess you could go all the way back to Real Madrid. AC Milan as well would be another good example of it. But they seem to have mastered this skill of finding the way to play consistently well and get the results in a knockout competition, which is the most difficult tournament in terms of, I wouldn't say necessarily guaranteeing success, but you're always there's always a potential there that one bad game can completely destroy a tournament. And now we're in a situation where Real Madrid are looking at the third win in a row. Zidane is known as a manager virtually nothing but has known nothing but success as far as the Champions League's concerned. So we've got Real Madrid, I think they would go into this game as favourites. You've got to acknowledge the performances in Liverpool against Manchester City in particular, the goals they've scored. You could point to perhaps a weakish group that they came out of. But then again, you look back to Real Madrid and they came out as runners-up in their group. They finished second to Tottenham. Borussia Dortmund were in that group. So maybe a little bit like the World Cup, it doesn't really matter so much where you finish in the group stage. It's the fact if you finish in the top two, get into the knockout stage and start working your way through from there. You look at Real Madrid's run, PSG, Juventus, Bayern Munich, that's a pretty, pretty tough set of games to come through, and to do it and make it to another Champions League final is an incredibly impressive feat. So you've got Liverpool on the other side coming through, Manchester City, I think a surprise, very much going into that as the underdog. I remember tweeting out the time the draw was made. I had a feeling, a little bit of the Arsenal-Chelsea feel from 2004 to this one potentially, with Arsenal being the dominant team in 2004, Chelsea kind of nipping at their heels very much from afar. In this case, it was Liverpool and Manchester City. And you know, Liverpool, over the two legs, won both legs, and then the Roma game, and both games at you know, we've got to remember at Anfield, where they started at an incredible pace, And one of the kind of features of Liverpool's season is this ability to up the pace and really, really frighten the shit out of defences. The mobility, the creativity they have up front with Firmino, Sane and Salah, with a, in many cases, a pretty ordinary midfield. And so, but that front three have the ability to absolutely terrify any defence in the world. So that's going to be one of the keys I think we're going to have to watch in the final on Saturday. Liverpool will up the tempo, whether they'll up the tempo from the beginning or whether there'll be a settling in period to calm the nerves a little bit. But certainly under Klopp, they will have that dynamic period where they'll really test Real Madrid. If Real Madrid can weather that, and I think if Real Madrid can go in that last 20 minutes of the game either tied or maybe even one goal down, I think then the pendulum really swings in favour of Real Madrid. And I think it swings in favour of Real Madrid because of the bench strength they've got. It looks like Ronaldo is going to be back after that foot injury or the ankle injury or leg injury, whatever it was, in El Clasico. And I think you'd have to absolutely saw his leg off from not to play in the final on Saturday. And we'll have a kind of resurgent Gareth Bale, who's been scoring goals. Just looking up his stats before we came on the air here. And interestingly enough, 38 appearances this year, which is a fair number of appearances, but he has had some injury problems. But he scored 19 goals this year, and a lot of them have come in the last little while. So he's whether he will start or whether, and I think there must be a temptation for Zidane to start him on the bench and use his strength and power, perhaps as Liverpool. Liverpool put so much effort into playing the way they do that maybe a fit, strong, running, you know, somebody who's in good form at the moment, coming off the bench with that kind of power in the last 20-25 minutes could be the kind of thing that's decisive in this game. So it's a game that, quite honestly, I wouldn't be shocked at any result. I wouldn't be shocked if it goes to penalty kicks. I wouldn't be shocked if one of the teams win by 3 or 4 goals and the other team win by 3 or 4 goals. I think it really is a toss-up, and it's going to be one of these situations we've seen, a game of very, very, there's going to be some key moments we're going to look back on and say that these were really important, they kind of swung the game, but it's going to be slim margins either way. I think it's going to be a great occasion. Unfortunately, it looks like some of the atmosphere in Kiev might be a bit of a, we're not quite sure how many people are actually going to get there and how many people are going to have hotels, or perhaps more importantly, how many people are going to be able to afford the exorbitant price that they're charging for hotels in Kiev. But it is going to be an occasion. So I know where I'm going to be Saturday afternoon, and I'm guessing that most of you will be the same. So we'll be back next week to talk about what actually happened in the Champions League. And of course, if you're looking for a sort of pre-game show, there's always Aston Villa and Fulham to watch. That's the game for the Premier League promotion playoff. Anybody who's watched the Premier League down the years is obviously very, very aware of these two teams. Fulham, possibly every US soccer fan's at least second favourite team in England, because of the high number of the significant number of American players that went through Fulham. In terms of Villa, 2 years looking to come back up. Steve Bruce. There's just some managers that are really good at getting teams out of the Championship. Once they get the Championship and into the Premier League, then you know, we're not quite so sure. But he looks like he's on the edge again of having some of that magic, waving his magic wand and getting Villa up. The amount of money is absolutely incredible when you include, look at the parachute payments. Of course, some of that revenue that the Villa or Fulham will get has to, you know, will be reinvested in transfers and bigger paychecks for the players now that they'll be playing in the Premier League. But even so, when you look at West Brom pocketing, I think, something like £93 million, which is what, about $126-130 million, and they finish bottom of the Premier League, and then there's parachute payments on top of that, and the parachute payments over the period of time should be about another £90 million. So, you know, it's there's a considerable amount at stake, and if you want to see two sets of nervous fans and two nervous managers, then that would be a game to watch on Saturday morning, as I say, a bit of the pre-game leading up into the Champions League in the afternoon. That brings me to the end of part two, and we'll be back with part three in a minute or so.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan. Be sure to follow them both on Twitter. Links are in the show notes below. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Soccer Report Extra Podcast. This weekend passed marked the moving on of, I think, three significant players. At least three significant players. Probably more out there, but these are the ones I feel I've got to give the nod to. They may turn up yet playing for other teams, but in terms of their association with the teams they're just leaving, I think it's fitting that we acknowledge them. So I just want to kind of take a minute or two to go through them. Andres Iniesta, whether he's going to go Manchester City as player coach, which is one of the rumours we're hearing, but I guess Arteta's not going to Arsenal, so probably Iniesta isn't going to Manchester City anymore. But it's essentially been a one-man club with Barcelona. Pretty much done everything that you could possibly expect or hope for in terms of club football, international football, the real blossoming of Spain as a full international force after threatening to do so and failing for so many years, finally coming to fruition in 2008 when they won the Euro 2008 and beating Germany in the final, through to South Africa in 2010, winning Euro again in 2012, bit of a failure in 2014. But Iniesta certainly been central to that, central as well to the success of Barcelona. The first time I can remember hearing the name Iniesta was actually, I think back in about, I'm going to say about 2001, might have been 2003, it was when the World Under-20s were out in the Middle East. And I remember Canada were playing, I believe Canada played Spain, and Iniesta was touted as the player to watch. And I think the thing I remember about him is he didn't seem to do very much. And I think, and that's not meant as an insult, that's actually meant as a compliment, because throughout his career, what Iniesta has managed to do that few players have ever been able to do, and are still many are unable to do, is to be incredibly effective, but to be so understated. The player that makes the correct choice with just about every pass, the player that makes himself available when his teammates are in trouble, the player that will turn a defender in midfield and suddenly, from being under pressure, a counter-attack has started. He does the little things so well, and he does the great things so well, but he does them with such fluency and grace that sometimes you can take him for granted. And I think that was perhaps a case earlier on in his career, as he's blossomed, scored the winning goal in South Africa, of course, in the 2010 World Cup to beat the Dutch in extra time. But that, just that ability to pick the right pass, to be brave on the ball, to make to the perfectly weighted pass, the timing of the pass was just absolutely exquisite. So whether Andres Iniesta is going to crop up in China, whether he's going to crop up in MLS, whether he's going to crop up in the Premier League at Manchester City, we'll just have to wait and see. But it brings to an end an era of Iniesta at Barcelona, and in many years, I know there'll be people out there telling their kids and their grandkids that they saw Iniesta play and he was one of the all-time greats. So I think acknowledgement to him, he's been an absolutely wonderful player to watch down the years. Second one I want to talk about is Fernando Torres, and it's rare, I think, to absolutely map to have a map of a career somewhat like Torres. Torres breaking in at Atletico Madrid when he was, I think he was 16, and absolutely touted as this phenomena. Boyhood supporter of Atletico Madrid. He was the fan star. But every time we waited for him to really break out on the international stage, he seemed to fluff his lines a bit. You go back to 2006, Spain had a great World Cup group stage and then came up against France and fell flat on their face. And so often, Spain had seemed to stumble at that important juncture. And then Torres came along. Atletico decided that they couldn't refuse the money that was being offered from Liverpool. Having Rafa Benitez at Anfield at that time probably helped a bit. But I think when you consider the struggles that Torres had late in his Liverpool career, but certainly at Chelsea and then at Milan and Atletico Madrid, you forget very easily that for a few seasons there, in my opinion, there was no better striker in the world. Torres, when he was feeding off the likes of Steven Gerrard and Alonso at Liverpool, was a force of nature. He was strong, he was powerful, he was lethal, he could score with his right, he could score with his left, he was quick, full of confidence, and then it all seemed to go south. The Chelsea move never worked out. I was going to say ill-advised, it's not for me to say whether it was ill-advised or not. But certainly Chelsea never got their money's worth, even though he was in the team that won the Champions League back through 2012 and had a role to play somewhat in that semi-final against Barcelona. But so it just seemed that the more he struggled to score, the more the pressure got to him, and it just became this downward spiral. And he got to a stage where you really felt sorry for him. He looked like he didn't even want the ball at times, and spells with Milan and then finishing up basically back at Atletico really hasn't worked out for him. Now, once again, we don't know where he's going to turn up. We don't know if he's going to where he's going to play, but I just want to acknowledge and, you know, sort of mention again that although in some quarters he's almost become a figure of fun over the last number of years because he struggles, but for that short period of time, he was a fantastic player. And that leads us to the last one, and we fully expected that Gianluigi Buffon would, at this point, be retired. We expected the Thursday press conference that he would announce his retirement. At 40, that was enough for him playing the goal. There's no World Cup to look forward to. But we kind of got this little bit of a mini bombshell from him that he's had offers from elsewhere. And maybe he certainly finished his Juventus career. But whether he's finished his goalkeeping career, we're not going to find out for maybe a few more days, maybe even a few more weeks. So there's still a little bit of uncertainty there. But you go back through Buffon's career, the time at Parma. Interestingly enough, of course, a weekend at Parma gets promoted back to Serie A, and anybody who watched Italian soccer in the 90s and the late 80s would know a lot about Parma. Parma were an absolutely terrific side. But Juventus scooped in, picked up Buffon, picked up Lilian Thuram at the same time. That goes back to, I think, about 2001. And I still think you can make the case that even though Ederson notionally went for more pounds, if you track it in terms of euros, which, you know, that was the currency that Buffon was bought in, that Buffon, 17 years on, is still the most expensive goalkeeper in the world, which I think tells you quite a bit. But he was an incredible servant. He didn't bail. Like Del Piero, he did not bail after Juventus were relegated. He stood by the team and been a significant part of Juventus re-establishing themselves as the preeminent force in Serie A soccer. During the time on the international scene, of course, there was the World Cup triumph in 2006, I think going into this one, there was the potential to break some records going into the next World Cup in terms of matching Lothar Matthäus and I think it's Carvalho. I've probably got that name a little bit wrong, but Mexican goalkeeper through the 60s and 70s, who both played in 5 World Cups. He would have matched that. He would have been his 6th World Cup, but 1 World Cup in 98. Buffon didn't actually appear, but that went by the way after Sweden stuck a bit of a pin in that balloon. But as I say, we'll have to wait with Buffon as well to find out whether he will managed to eke out a season, maybe even 2 seasons. Let's face it, goalkeepers can go on a little bit longer. He's gone on long enough, but he could still probably got another couple of years out of him. You look back to the likes of Dino Zoff, was 40 when he won the World Cup in 82 with Italy. Peter Shilton went on for a number of years as well. A number of other goalkeepers have played into their 40s. It's not an unknown phenomena, and Buffon might be the latest. But another, I think you certainly term along with Iniesta, one of the greatest players certainly I've seen in my time, and that's quite a time. Whatever he decides, we'll just have to the great fans of Buffon will hope that he plays another couple of years, but we'll have to wait and see for that decision. That brings us to the end of part 3. We'll be back with part 4 in just a second.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra. Keep up to speed with the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen by liking us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Soccer Report Extra podcast wrap-up, and this is when we call upon producer Luke Crawford to look in the record books. What did we get right? What did we get wrong? What's it about this week, Luke?
Well, we got one little correction, I guess, is to do with Real Madrid and their proficiency in the original European Cup finals.
Yeah.
You have some stats here. I think they were in 8 of 11 of the first finals of the competition. So they only missed 3 finals, but in 64-65, they were not defeated in the final by Inter. They were actually eliminated at the quarterfinal stage by Benfica, who were the losers in the final to Inter Milan.
And Benfica had a quite good run around that time as well. They had about 4 or 5 finals, I think. They beat Barcelona, I think they beat Real Madrid, and then they lost to Milan, and then they came back for that game against Inter as well. So that was, I guess, when the infamous curse of Bela Gutman came in, who'd quit after, I think, the 62 final and reputedly said that Benfica would never win another trophy again. And they haven't since then in the European Cup.
And then we also were talking about the 81 European Cup final. So that was at Parc des Princes. Liverpool did win 1-0. The goal scored in the 82nd minute by Alan Kennedy.
I think Del Bosque maybe played in that game. Maybe he was injured for that game. No, he wasn't. Del Bosque actually played.
There you go.
There you go. And also some names from the past during Jose Antonio Camacho, the great sweater. Remember? And I don't mean wearing the great sweater. I mean the great sweater.
Yeah, he should wear black most days, I think.
Yes. White was not his colour.
No.
He played in that game. Uli Stielike, who... German striker, but also played midfield, also could play centre-half as well. He played in that team as well. Juanito was a great... and Santillana, another well-known Spanish Real Madrid player. But also, and I know some of the listeners of the podcast will be shouting at me to mention this, but also played in that final was Laurie Cunningham, who tragically died in a car crash. But Laurie Cunningham had went to Real Madrid from West Brom, and Laurie Cunningham actually played in that final. Manager was Bushkov, the Yugoslavian coach, and I don't think I've got to go into the Liverpool lineup for all the Liverpool fans out there that probably recite it, but I'll just mention there were 3 Scotsmen on the team. Everybody else, including the substitute bench, was English, and so was the manager. Completely. You wouldn't see that nowadays, would you?
Indeed not, no.
No, Alan Hansen, Kenny Dalglish and Graeme Souness. And Dalglish went off after 84th minute. But Alan Kennedy, as you point out, got the goal. And I think Liverpool fans would be happy if they got the same result. But they'd also be surprised if it was only 1-0.
I think so too, with the amount of firepower going on the park come the weekend. We're also talking about to whet our appetites to check out the promotion playoff final between Aston Villa and Fulham. I just wanted to mention that it's also some Canadians' favorite second club because Thomas Rosicky used to play for Fulham.
That's
as
right.
Well.
Yes. Rosicky had a good spell with Fulham as well. Very effective player after I think it was Anderlecht where he first came to prominence, if I remember rightly.
Mm, they also famously also had a statue in front of Craven Cottage of Michael Jackson.
Yes.
I'm not sure. Has it been removed?
I think it was going to be removed after
Mohamed Al-Fayed.
Yeah. Because I remember back to the old Fox Soccer Report days. That was always worth a giggle, wasn't it?
Well, it was just a horrendous statue. I mean, it was like something from Madame Tussauds had actually been left out in the sun a little bit too long.
Talking about that, and I don't know if you caught this today, now, but we're wandering into territory we probably shouldn't wander into here. But Brandy Chastain, who famously scored that winning penalty in, I guess that was the 99 Women's World Cup.
Yeah, in the sports bra. I actually saw the sports bra in person when I went to Beaverton to go to Nike HQ, the World Campus.
Well, check out on Twitter her bronze kind of, it's not a statue, it's a kind of engraving of her.
Okay.
At some Hall of Fame.
Uh-oh.
It's not very, it's right up there with the Ronaldo's. I think they got,
oh, geez.
I think maybe it was the same guy that did Ronaldo.
Oh no.
As somebody commented on Twitter today, it looks a bit like Jonathan Winters.
What I always find horrible about bronzes, if it's a full bust or if it's even just a relief, is when they show a smile with teeth. It looks like a horse face. Like, just do it with your mouth shut. Don't you have any nice pictures where you don't have your mouth agog? Like, I don't know. It just looks horrible.
Well, the Brandy Chastain has become the latest to regret not getting the first right of disapproval on any likeness that we're using. It really is.
It's that's
quite abhorrent. It's terrible, but.
And then speaking of Fulham, you mentioned because of the American influence at Fulham, Eddie Johnson, of course, used to play for Fulham.
Brian McBride.
Eddie Johnson was one of the top scorers at the Emirates 2003 World Youth Championship for the U.S.
Oh, there you go.
Which was the tournament where Spain faced Canada in the quarterfinals, beating them 2-1. Who scored for Canada, Bobby?
Oh, Will Johnson.
Close. Ian Hume.
Well.
An absolute rocket.
Yeah,
and then
how did the scoring go in that one, Luke? Did
it was Iniesta first, I think the 20th minute, and then Hume in the 27th, and then Arizmendi in extra time. It went tooth and nail for that was an excellent game.
Yeah, who won that one?
Canada acquitted themselves quite well.
Who actually won the tournament in 2003?
The tournament was 1-0 final, Spain losing to Brazil.
Oh, okay,
who scored the winning goal for Brazil?
Kaká.
Close. Fernandinho.
close in as much as Brazilian.
Exactly. The top scorer of the tournament was Dudu.
Oh, Dudu that finished up as a left backy?
Central midfielder.
Did he not finish
up? Ended up in back to Brazil. He's at Botafogo right now.
Is he? Is it Dudu that played in Germany?
He had stints with Castro Reysol, then Rennes in France, then CSKA Moscow, then Olympiacos, and then back to Brazil, where he went to Mineiro, Goiás.
Different Dudu.
Yeah.
Wrong Dudu.
Dudu Kaká.
But I don't know. I know this isn't going to make me look real good. But you know what I find fascinating is you go back through these age group tournaments and you see the quality of players that came through, particularly through the under 20s. Like I go back to the under 20 tournament in Canada. That was a great tournament.
Yeah.
Like, there were so many good
players. An entire generation of world-class players.
Absolutely fantastic. Aguero, Suarez, Cavani, Zarate, Romero, who's going to miss the World Cup because he's injured, Fazio, Benega.
That Argentinian team alone was just epic.
Vidal for Chile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was a whole bunch of Sanchez for Chile, another one that comes to mind. The Czechs got the final, but didn't really produce any great international players from that time. Same with Austria; they were, I think, they finished up. But Michael Bradley, I remember, I was at the US game where they beat Uruguay. I think in the maybe the last 16, and then they lost to Austria in the last day. But Bradley, I think Altidore was in that team as well. You go back through them, there was some really, really good players. There must be another one coming up soon. They're every odd year, aren't they? So next year we can look forward to one again.
Exactly.
Yeah, and a Women's World Cup. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, aren't we? We've got Champions League and we've got Fulham and Villa on Saturday. Thanks very much for listening. On behalf of Luke Crawford, myself, Bobby McMahon, and Owen O'Callaghan, who couldn't be with us this week, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you'll be back next week. Thank you very much. For someone who's so keen to snuggle, you
cause a lot of trouble. Thanks for listening to Soccer Report Extra. To keep tabs on the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen, like us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Music for this podcast graciously provided by Manitoba's hottest indie pop group, Misery Slims. Check them out on Spotify and YouTube, and follow the band on Facebook at Misery Slims.